the music. Cut the music.
I think I got my swagger back.
Spectacular group of men. You go find them, you throw your arms around them, you give them a big kiss on the mouth if you're a girl.
Oh, the band is out on the field. He's going to go into the end zone.
There goes Davis.
Oh, my God.
Davis is going to run it all the way back. Auburn's going to win the football game. Auburn's going to win the football game.
Like poison. Like rat poison.
Are you going to listen to me or are you going to listen to these guys?
And welcome to the College Football Country podcast. My name is Josh Parcell, the founder of College Football Country. Thank you guys so much for listening. If this is your first time ever listening to College Football Country, thank you for giving it a chance. And don't forget the rules. Go leave a rating and review if you like it. 5-star rating. And when you leave the review, you got to name your favorite college football player ever. Everybody knows the rules by now. No, I'm not Dave Portnoy. I'm not El Prez. But everybody does know the rules. Leave the name of your favorite college football player or the most random college football player you can think of. Those are the rules. That's the game. Go play it. Leave that rating and review. Today, I have George Sedano from ESPN. Now he's out in LA. Used to be a radio talk show host based out of Miami. Big Miami guy. He's the best person I could think of to talk to about the Hurricanes, who are absolutely struggling this season. I've been hard on the Hurricanes for a long time, and George has come back at me a few times on Twitter. We've had some fun debates, so I thought this was a great week to have him on. Virginia Tech taking on Miami. We don't get into the game at all, so don't worry if you're not a Virginia Tech or a Miami fan. No big deal. It's not a preview or anything like that. Just talking about really what's gone wrong at Miami and how maybe it can be fixed, if it could ever be fixed. We'll talk about that and more. And then after that, Mark Ennis from Louisville, ESPN Radio in Louisville. He'll join me to talk about the Bobby Petrino firing, if Jeff Brohm really is the guy at Louisville. If it's not Jeff Brohm, where do they go? Kind of gives you some background on what happened, just what the heck went wrong for Bobby Petrino at Louisville and how they can get out of this mess down there in Kentucky, because it's an absolute wreck right now. So it's just a misery podcast all around with Miami and Louisville. And I've got an exciting podcast coming up for you guys next time too. Probably going to come out Thursday night, I'm hoping, so you guys will definitely have it by Friday morning. Not only will I have my picks for the week, I'll also have Dave Clawson, the head coach from Wake Forest, join me as well. But I'm going to break down and rank the top 25 coaching jobs in college football. I got the idea after Bobby Petrino being fired at Louisville, and I wondered, is Louisville a top 25 job? And I decided to kind of write down who I think the top 25 jobs are. It's harder than you think, and there's more schools that fit that mold than there are spots available. There's some good schools, some really good jobs that don't crack the top 25. You'll probably be surprised at one of the schools that I leave out. So I will rank 25 through 1, the best coaching jobs in college football, in the next podcast. It's going to be a loaded one for sure. But right now, we're going to focus on Miami. We're going to focus on Louisville. No playoff rankings tonight reaction because, quite honestly, there was no surprises. The top 10 all won for the first time in almost a decade. There was no drama. Nothing really changed. Nice win for Clemson. They did what they were supposed to do against BC. Alabama, nice win for them against Alabama. Got a nice win, of course, against Mississippi State. There's some drama surrounding Tua Tagovailoa. Quick thoughts on that. Nick Saban is out of his mind if he decides to go with Tua this weekend against the Citadel. This is an easy game for him to rest Tua, sit him out, let him come back against Auburn in 2 weeks, and then, of course, Georgia in the SEC championship game. This is a high-risk, no-reward spot for Nick Saban if he wants to play Tua, but it sounds like that's who he's going to go with. I can't believe that's what he's going to do. I can't believe that's the move. I know the philosophy at Alabama is they treat every game the same. They treat every practice the same. There's really no difference. It's very robotic in Alabama. Every day it's focusing on a process. It's a very microscopic view of the program, of the process. They don't really look at the big picture so much. At least the players don't. They're very focused on every little moment, every little detail, and it doesn't matter what the opponent is that week. And of course, the Citadel is no different. Nick Saban's going to give Tua the start. We'll see how long he plays, but I can't believe he's playing him at all, given the knee trouble that Tua's had over the last few weeks. So that's my quick thought on Nick Saban. Nothing else really in the top 25 to react to. Big game this weekend, of course, Notre Dame taking on Syracuse in Yankee Stadium. I'll have more thoughts on that in the next podcast. I think this is a spot for Notre Dame. If they're going to lose, this might be the week. So big opportunity for Syracuse. Not the last time you'll hear about Syracuse, or at least their coach, in this podcast. There's a little tease for you when we talk to Mark Ennis a little bit later. So right now we're going to talk about Miami and what the heck is going wrong with the Hurricanes this year. They are 5-5. Here to talk about that right now is ESPN's George Sedano. Welcome on to the College Football Country Podcast, ESPN's George Sedano. And George, usually when I welcome people in, I like to list all the accomplishments, all of their accolades, whatever jobs they're doing. I've had a lot of people with a lot of different jobs. I feel like you might be near the top. It's become kind of a running joke on the show. Who can have the most different jobs or occupations when they come on CFB Country? But you kept it simple. You just said, just go ESPN's George Sedano. I like that you're simple. You get right to the point.
Yeah, man, because I do way too many things at this place to be sitting here listing. We'll be on here for like 20 minutes. The whole 20 minutes will be what I do for the damn company. So, no, it's just pointless to do that. ESPN's George Sedano makes it all worth it. Go on my Twitter. I think it says everything I do there.
I like it. We'll cut right to the chase. Well, one of the main things you do, you host a radio show in L.A. I'm willing to bet you guys probably don't lead your show every day talking Miami football.
No, I don't. But my group chat amongst my childhood friends pretty much leads with Miami football every morning.
Okay, so you have an outlet to vent your frustrations, because I feel like I'm just trying to give you a place. Look, I'm going to be venting too. This is going to be a therapy session for the two of us because Virginia Tech Miami is this Saturday, and I don't think either one of us saw this year coming, for either from the Miami point of view or from a Virginia Tech point of view, but you're a Miami guy, I'm a Tech guy. I figured this was the perfect week for us to get together. What the hell's going on?
Well, look, man, I think that there was going to be some natural regression with Miami. I didn't think it would be this, as you kind of pointed out to that. But the reality is Mark Richt might have done the best coaching job he's done in a really long time last season, because Miami wasn't as good as the record indicated it was. And if you saw that, if you saw the last three games they played, all losses, you could tell that that was the case. They clearly weren't on the same level playing field as Clemson. I thought that he did a nice job of keeping them in that Wisconsin game. They had some moments and opportunities to win that bowl game. But even the Pitt game, every team, that was their last loss during the regular season. Every team will have kind of one of those turd games. And I just thought maybe that was that. But no, what had happened was clearly Pat Narduzzi, who's a good defensive coach, had figured out, Miami's been trying to hide their quarterback all year last year. And Mark Richt did a really good job of that for 10 weeks, basically. And then eventually there's enough film that people figured that out. So going into this season with, in theory, more talent than they had last season, although I would argue against that, they were not able to do that as well as they did last year, because now you have not only 10 weeks of film like Narduzzi had last year, you have 13 weeks of film, including three losses. So, yeah, that's reality, and that's the world of college football. People in Miami, Josh, are freaking out, screaming about play calling and this, that, and the other. And, look, I'm not saying that that stuff doesn't have a place in the discussion, but what I'm telling you is that's like worrying about the furniture inside a house where the foundation isn't set and stable. And Miami's foundation, which should be their quarterback, and even their offensive line, which has been atrocious. It might be the worst offensive line they've had in a long time. That's the bigger problem here, is the lack of talent at those positions. And what I keep getting back at me like a furnace blast of heat is, they're always in the top 7 or 8 or 10 or whatever it is in recruiting and blah, 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 blah. And that's absolutely true. That is the case. But I don't know about you. You are more into college football than even I am. Like, I am more than just a casual fan. But I've always held a firm belief that the star system is flawed in a lot of ways. Not to say it hasn't come a long way. Look, the days of Ed Reed being a two-star recruit are long and gone. Like, you're not having those issues necessarily. But what I would say to you is, if the NFL, which has unbelievably more resources than a college football team, even a team like Alabama, okay, they got way more resources than them, mess this thing up and screw it up with 21 and 22 and maybe even 23-year-olds in some cases in the NFL draft, then the star system has no chance of being as accurate even as the NFL draft. I would say at best, 60-70% of that and probably less. So if you get busts at a 50-50 rate in the first round of the NFL draft, that's going to happen when you're dealing with the star system for the most part. And I know somebody in your audience who's listening to this will, you know, fire back with the last top, five-star guys and how they all made it, et cetera, et cetera. And that's fine, but I'm not just talking about five-star guys because there's only so many of those that go around, which, by the way, and I'm I'm going on a little too long here because I want you to respond, there's not as many five-star guys as there used to be. It's a lot of four-star guys, a lot of three-star guys, and what, maybe 15, 20 five-star guys tops?
Mm-hmm.
So that has been rectified to some extent, but that's kind of my point, is that there's still a lot of misses in those three- and four-star recruits where we thought those guys would be good. And that's not to absolve Mark Richt of some of those mistakes, because clearly he doesn't have a quarterback. It's year three. That's on him. The offensive line is not as good as it should be. That's on him or his offensive line coach. But, yeah, I think what's happened here, and this is what happens in college football particularly, is that everyone yells and screams and overrates their talent when some of it isn't necessarily all on the coaching staff. Like, these coaches know their talent better than we do. And I think that gets dismissed summarily, and I don't believe in that.
Well, and look, the point about recruiting, collectively, recruiting rankings are usually fairly accurate enough. Now, there's going to be misses here and there. They're never an exact science. And to your point, too, they've gotten better over the years. There's more exposure to these kids. You've got better scouts, honestly, evaluating these kids. Not the best scouts necessarily, but better ones. So it is getting better in terms of how accurate they are. I think talent is not the problem at Miami for the most part. There's a lot of schools that win with less talent than them. It's about how do you develop them when they get onto your campus. You know, I don't want to turn this into a X's and O's breakdown of Miami's offensive line, but you and I both know, watching that offensive line, that it's not up to par for a competitive ACC program, let alone one that wants to win championships. So Miami's always had talent. They've always had elite talent. It's not even so much about, what five-star guys are you bringing in? Because like you said, even in Alabama is only going to bring in five of them a year. Okay, there's 80 other players to go around your roster. So you're building that roster with, what are the other, 18 to 20 guys on your recruiting class every year? What do they look like? How do you develop them? That's where your team is built, especially when you start talking about the offensive line, the lines of scrimmage, and places like that. And to me, Miami has done a poor job predating Mark Richt for a long time at winning football games with and developing a team. George, I mean, not only is Miami recruiting well, they're putting out NFL players. I mean, the guys that come through Miami go to the league.
I mean, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm with you to an extent, right? Like, I am absolutely with you on the fact that Larry Coker, Randy Shannon, Al Golden did an unbelievably terrible job at developing talent. No question about that. I don't necessarily think that's the case here, not in the same vein as it was with those guys. Because if you look at Miami's defense, I don't think that they're unbelievably special Miami defense like we may have seen, 15, 20 years ago or beyond that. But I do think they're good enough. I mean, right. They're, top 5 or 10 in most categories. I believe at worst in the major categories, they're top 25. I just think where Miami struggles a little bit is that they're still trying to figure this out from a depth perspective. And, I think when you don't have, on offense particularly, a ton of depth along the offensive line, clearly no depth at quarterback, I think that's going to hurt you. Because the defense has kept them in pretty much all these games. They're good enough on that side of the ball to be in these games. But offensively, I don't believe they have the type of impact talent that you would want to have. Dabo Swinney, guys that are juniors that could leave for the NFL and could be first and second round talent are sticking around.
Yeah.
Miami has guys that leave, as juniors that are third and fifth round talents. Like that's the type of stuff where I think he needs to do a better job of. And if they built the depth, then they can overwhelm people in the ACC with their talent again. And here's the other part of it. Okay. You mentioned coaching and developing, and I do think that does play a factor, okay? If we're assigning, if this is a pie, right? I think that there is a slice of the pie that is that. I don't think there's any doubt. But Miami, for all the money they spent on Mark Richt, and it was, I think, $4 million a year, they still don't spend a ton on their assistants. Whereas the elite of the elite in college football, in an arms race, are spending that. Nick Saban tried to offer jobs to Chris Carter, to Ricky Williams, to guys like that, who basically said to Nick, oh, you can't afford me. And he said, really? Hold my beer. You know, Dabo Sweeney, I believe Brent Venables makes $2 million a year. Okay. I would venture to say that in, you know, to compare it to Miami in this case, and my guess is Virginia Tech is in this same realm with after Bud Foster, is that $2 million for Brent Venable is probably more than all of Miami's assistants combined. And Manny Diaz makes a pretty penny. It's not like he's not making anything. So it's that part of the arms race where I think Miami is failing itself. It's where Mark Richt is trying to put his son as the quarterback's coach. It's where, you know, he's got an offensive line coach that isn't as good. It's that he can't keep his defensive line coach because Alabama's willing to pay him a ton more than Miami can. So it's all those things combined. It's not one particular thing with Miami. It's just a ton of little things that just add up to this. Now, it shouldn't be this. But when you have a crappy quarterback and you have a crappy offensive line, this is what ends up happening.
Well,
and that look, ultimately is on Mark Richt.
It is, and he's got to find a guy. I mean, Rozier was not his recruit. Perry was, I believe, was part of that first class.
Yes.
But you know, it's and if Perry turns out to be a great player for the next 2 years, which he very well could be, then that looks good on Richt. But you know, just ask Texas how much success you can have when you recruit five stars all over the place and can't get it right at quarterback, because that position makes all the difference in the world. I mean, you can be an elite program and recruit at an elite level. If you don't get it right at quarterback, you're not competing for championships no matter how good you are everywhere else. And I think you bring up a really good point about that, you know, the quarterback position, but also the, I don't want to say lack of support, but just the inability for them to keep up with the Clemsons and Alabamas and Ohio States of the world, who are just pouring money left and right, have world-class facilities, which Miami doesn't have the same facilities that those upper echelon programs have. Those are the things that fans aren't going to notice when they flip on their TV on a Saturday and they watch and they say, well, why is Miami losing to Pitt, or why are they losing to every other school in the ACC? Well, it's all of the infrastructure that nobody wants to really pay attention to. Those are the foundations of your program, and that's what Mark Richt is battling at Miami, and he's not the only coach. They've dealt with that in the past as well.
To your point, Mark Richt, they just built a brand new indoor facility,
right,
and it's really nice. Don't get me wrong. He put $1 million of his own money into that thing.
Right.
Okay?
And it took them way too long to get it.
Right. And look, it's fine. But, you know, in comparison, Alabama, I believe, just finished building like some sort of like mental health, behavioral health, you know, counseling type facility just for their football team. Forget about the indoor practice facility with a weight room and all the, you know, top notch equipment. I'm talking about just to have them deal with whatever emotional stuff kids go through.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they have their own building just for that.
Right.
At least that's what it was told to me by someone recently. And that's the type of stuff they're doing. They're light years ahead of everyone else. And look, even within the state, Florida, who's, look, had their own set of issues too, but even they've got a ton more money pouring into their program. And this is the thing. When people look at Miami, and I don't think enough people know this, Josh, Miami is a small private school with an undergrad enrollment of about 10,000, okay? Mm-hmm. Where Miami has always made its money is its graduate programs. It's got an unbelievable law school, got an unbelievable, like, second to none almost in the region when it comes to a medical program. You know, so those kind of things are what Miami really is. It just happened that Howard Schnellenberger created this monster that Jimmy Johnson then took to a different level, and then Dennis Erickson reaped the benefits of, right? Like, that's kind of what happened, because you happen to be in this fertile recruiting ground where some of the best athletes in all of the world happen to live in. So a lot of it is happenstance, okay, and circumstance. And the assumption that Miami was going to be able to keep that up, look, I just think that was flawed logic from the get-go, because eventually people are going to keep coming down here and steal your players.
Right.
And, you know, I don't have to, you know, sit here and give you a dissertation on, you know, everything that's been covered in Billy Corbin's two movies about them. But basically, once they went on probation, that was a problem. Now, look, Butch Davis was able to resurrect it. I think that, again, he took advantage of a system that we talked about earlier where Ed Reed was a two-star recruit. When you watched Ed Reed, clearly Butch Davis is like, that guy is not a two-star recruit. That guy's amazing. So I think that he was able to find, you know, a chink in the armor, per se, of the system and allow him to kind of take advantage of the inefficiencies of the system then. Now, there are no – at least I don't see it. There aren't very many inefficiencies in the system now when it comes to recruiting college football, or as many as there were clearly back then when Miami could take advantage of it, or Florida State or Florida. Because, look, all three of those schools kind of stink right now. I mean, Florida State is at a whole different level of stink, which is amazing to watch as it unfolds. But that's part of it, is that they took advantage of a market inefficiency for many, many, many years, and that no longer is a market inefficiency.
Yeah, and you know, talking about recruiting, Miami's not the only school kind of dealing with this, where recruiting has become so much more national and it is so much less territorial, where it's harder and harder to put a fence around your county or your state or whatever it is and fight off those other, you know, bigger schools from coming in and, you know, Alabama taking Amari Cooper or Florida State coming in and stealing Dalvin Cook from your backyard.
Ohio State has a pipeline to Broward County, which is where Fort Lauderdale here in Florida. Like, I mean, they take St. Thomas Aquinas High School has a pipeline to Ohio State, basically.
Yep. And it's harder and harder for schools to protect their backyard, even though Miami can still go out and get 20 kids without having to leave the county and still compete. It's not the same as it used to be. Now, I know we don't have a ton of time, and I want to give you a chance to rake me through the coals, because I know I fired you up a few weeks ago, or well, gosh, almost 2 months ago now, at the beginning of the season. I've had this theory about Miami and USC specifically, that in the last 25, 30 years, when those programs were at their best, they had so much talent. I don't think it mattered who was really coaching, not to take away from Butch Davis or Pete Carroll what they did. But you're talking about the only times where they won was when they had the greatest teams in the history of football, in the history of the sport. That was when they won. I feel like there's, and you've been there, you've been around Miami, and you've been around that program at least enough to kind of maybe answer this a little bit.
And I've been around USC enough, too, over
exactly.
the years.
Exactly, so. Yeah, perfectly. And I just feel like it's really hard. I've lived in around USC as well for a time. It's really hard for 18, 19, 20-year-old kids who have the bravado and the attention that comes along with being a premier athlete, a college football player at those universities. There's a lot of distractions. There's a lot more to do in Miami. There's a lot more to do in LA than there is in Tuscaloosa or in Columbus or in Happy Valley. Like, I feel like it's a lot harder these days, and it always has been, I think, for these schools to succeed, because there's just so many distractions. I feel like that has to play a role at some point.
See, here's where I think you're wrong, okay? And I think we kind of started to have this discussion on Twitter.
Yeah.
Is the kids who generally are being recruited by Miami and USC are kids who grew up in LA or Miami. Mm-hmm. So they're not, those things aren't distractions. Like, they've been doing all those things all their lives.
Well, they weren't 12 years old going on, you know, hanging out on a yacht. I hope.
No, you know, listen, man, I would say this, like when the whole Nevin Shapiro thing happened, and by the way, you know, Nevin and I have had a lot of conversations, even while he was in jail. Like, he was trying to give that information to me.
Yeah.
And I was like, are you insane? Like, I don't want to touch that stuff. First of all, I'm not even an investigative journalist. Like, what are we talking about here? Like, he called my radio station, and we had him on the air once when I was in Miami.
Wow.
So he was someone that would reach out to me constantly. But I would tell him, yeah, like, clearly all those things were violations, but I would say, come on, Nevin, those things are a Tuesday in Miami. Like, we all know that kids are going to clubs with fake IDs. I did it, and I'm not an athlete. You know what I mean? Like, what are we talking about here? So, like, that stuff is not new to them. Whereas, for example, I don't know Tuscaloosa like that, so I'm not going to, you know, question it, but I do know Gainesville, okay? And if you look back at Urban Meyer's run there, and, you know, there was a lot of stuff being covered up, clearly, as we look back at it. And you can do that in a small town a lot easier than you can do it in a large municipality.
Yes.
And that was my point. And to your larger point that Miami and USC have only been able to do it when they've had some of the greatest teams of all time, I mean, you could kind of say that about everybody. I mean, Alabama's had a run of some of the greatest teams of all time. When they do those lists, five or six of them are these Alabama teams we're seeing here. You know, Florida, that group we were just talking about with Tebow and Harvin and all those guys, like, that's one of some of the greatest groups of teams we've ever seen, too. Like, generally, that's how it works. If you are considered one of the greatest teams, it's because you have some of the best collection of talent. That's still generally the way it works. And to give you an example, what I do know about Tuscaloosa, and this was pointed out to me by a buddy of mine, that if you look at that 2015 Alabama National Championship team, I don't believe there's very many, if any, players left from that team that haven't gone to the NFL. Mm-hmm. That, again, should all be on this roster. They've transferred to other schools because Nick basically is like, oh, I want the newer model. I mean, you're cool, but if you didn't make it to the NFL, your scholarship is revocable. You should transfer because I'm going to bring in a newer, nicer model, much like John Calipari does in college basketball, or did in college basketball for a long time at Kentucky. So that's part of this, too, is that if you and if you don't believe me, if you go to, like, the Birmingham newspapers, they keep tabs on the kids that should be on this team that were on the 2015 National Championship team and tell you how they're doing at their new schools. So, yeah, like, I do think that when you're talking about, you know, some of the great teams, of course they're going to have the best talent. That's generally the reason why they win.
I think, of course, but I think my point is with Miami, they're either a national championship contender or they're 7-5, 8-4.
Oh, but look at last year. That's not the case.
Yeah, but again, you even said yourself that they overachieved last season, and they were a 10-3 team. And that was the first year in 15 that they were even played for an ACC title. Like, they went 15 years without being relevant.
Look, they had a 9-win season under Al Golden. I think they had a 9-win season under Randy. Like, they do have
here
those
and
seasons.
There. But, like, Florida State, and now this is the wrong time to make this argument because of where Florida State is this year, but for the last 25 years, Florida State has been in and out of the ACC championship playing in New Year's Bowls most years, even when they weren't competing for the national championship. Like, they were still very good. To me, Miami, it was like you either had so much talent that you dominated everybody you played, or you're 8-4, 9 wins every now and then, 7 wins, 6-win season here and there. Like, I just feel like there's a bigger gap between Miami. Well, it could be.
Right. Sure, but Florida State has always had the benefit of having really good coaching. Like, this is the first time Miami's actually paid for a real coach. I mean, think about who they hired. I mean, Larry Coker was the assistant everyone loved, right, on the team. And I'll never forget this. I had several players who played on that team, and I'm still friendly with a ton of them, who told me at the time, okay, I was like a young media type at that time, just breaking into radio, basically. And they told me, George, you can coach us, and we're going to win the national championship.
Well,
like,
yeah.
Legitimately. And I might have. But that's kind of the point, right? And they had – so Larry was cheap. Randy Shannon was clearly cheap. Al Golden, the Temple coach, coached Miami. Are we serious
that's easy in hindsight. He was a great hire at the time. People loved him at the time.
That was not easy in hindsight. Even in the moment, I was like, why are they hiring the Temple coach?
People thought he should have gotten the Penn State job. Penn State and Miami are on par.
Yeah, well, he should have.
I'm sure that you
should have stayed away from Miami.
Oh, man. All right, I know I got to let you go. I feel like we could go on for an hour, but this was perfect right ahead of Miami. Real quick, who wins, Miami, Virginia Tech?
I mean, can they both lose? I mean, is it possible feels to like still it. Tie? It feels it's not like possible it. To still tie, right?
No, not anymore.
Yeah. I mean, listen, I'm going to just go with the math, and the math says Miami should win, right?
Like,
for that reason alone, I'm going to do that. Like, the Vegas, the odds makers, the ESPN Football Power Index all think Miami should win, so I'm going to go with that. But the way this season is going, nothing would surprise me.
You don't know. Well, I'm going Miami, too. So, anyway, George, thanks so much, man. That was a lot of fun. We'll do it again sometime. Maybe you can come back on and gloat next week when Miami beats Tech by 30.
You got it, bud. Anytime.
All right. Welcome on Mark Ennis, Louisville expert, Louisville radio host, and the only guy I could think of to have this conversation in the wake of Bobby Petrino making his exit from Louisville over the weekend. And Mark, man, heck of a time for you.
Yeah, it's been, I mean, honestly, I could sort of draw this back for the better part of 3 years and change between everything that's going on with basketball, the university itself, and now with the football program. It's been nonstop, just sort of a circus, you know, around here. I think no one in radio has had an easier time overall with show prep, you know, material to start with than I have really since I started this job a couple of years ago, because it's been one event after another. It's in one larger-than-life personality crashing and burning in front of everybody after another. It's very, very crazy around here, for sure.
Is there a light at the end of the tunnel? You guys, you know, Chris Mack is now taking charge of the basketball program. It feels like everything's under control on that side. How do you feel about the football program now moving forward? We'll talk about who's going to be the guy. Maybe not Jeff Brohm. Who knows? But we'll talk about that. But just how are you feeling about the future of the Louisville athletic department as a whole right now?
Yeah, I think this really felt like the last, to a lot of people, including me, this really felt like the last part of kind of a cleansing, you know. And I think, look, Tom Jurich and the people that he hired have been enormously successful. And most of those people in terms of the coaches are still here. But when it comes to the name money-making brands of your program, I mean, Rick Pitino and Bobby Petrino, larger than life figures, enormously successful, and not liked by almost anybody. And I think there was going to be a time where eventually those people would be gone. And I think it sort of happened fast. But this sort of felt like this is the end of that previous era of those kinds of people being in charge of the premier programs. And so this feels like kind of the light at the end of the tunnel. Vince Tyree is just a different kind of guy. Chris Mack is a different kind of guy than Rick Pitino was. And I suspect that the replacement for Bobby Petrino will be in that same mold. And I think people need that. There's been kind of a re-engagement with fans in particular and former players here that predated the previous people that I think has been really refreshing to people that was sorely needed.
You know, I'm thinking back to 2 years ago when, you know, Lamar wins the Heisman. You guys are 9-1 heading in towards that final stretch of the season. And look, everybody knew the type of guy Bobby Petrino was way before that. I mean, when they hired him the second time, they knew what they were getting. Did you get the sense that when things were going really well at their absolute best, that did people still have questions about Petrino, or were they willing for the most part to just sweep those under the rug? And as long as you're winning at a high level, and Louisville was at one point, were they okay with having him running the show?
You know, I think that he was on his P's and Q's for about 2.5-ish years, right up until, I would say, the WikiLeaks incident, which is really where things started to go downhill from there. And he didn't really do anything in that. But it was like the first kind of chink in the armor in terms of just behavior from anybody involved in it. And if you look at Louisville's record since then, since the WikiLeaks game, I think they went 10-18 after that. And that's really where I think that you started to sow discord on the staff. And that's where the relationship with Todd Grantham started to go sour. And really, ultimately, Bobby's legacy is about how well he can keep a good staff together or not, because he needs people around him to overcome where he's not a good person. And he was able to do that early on here. He was able to do it here the first time. He was able to do it at Arkansas. But once things went south with Todd Grantham, everything went south. And I think the results kind of show that. But, you know, a lot of people didn't want him to come back, but were willing to tolerate it because they knew you were going to win. But he, you know, when you set it up that bottom line oriented, he either better win and win a lot, or he's not worth having. And he ended up being the latter.
Yeah, well, and as soon as things go south and you start losing the way they're losing, there's no reason to keep a guy like that around. So Jeff Brohm, obviously the guy. I've never heard of an AD openly speak about the number one candidate before they've even interviewed him. It's just kind of wild times down there. This feels like Jim Harbaugh at Michigan. It feels like Scott Frost at Nebraska. I mean, this is the chosen son, the former quarterback 20 years ago. Can he come back and rectify the program? Is it that simple? Like, do Louisville fans feel, how confident do Louisville fans feel, and the athletic department for that matter, if you have any insight there, into how likely it is this guy actually comes back?
Yeah, and I hope people understand it's not just because he's the local guy. Like, he's also doing a pretty good job.
Right, exactly.
You know, at Purdue and at Western Kentucky. And is just he's the kind of unassuming, you know, figure that very much fits in the Vince Tyree, Chris Mack mold. You know, he's not, you know, I think when Tom Jurich came here and was kind of a larger than life kind of enforcer kind of figure, they needed big, huge, brash personalities because they were trying to be upwardly mobile. They needed Rick Pitino, and they needed Bobby Petrino, and they needed him to like kick ass and push upward. And now I don't think they need that as much as they need people re-engaged, because I think people were just sort of burned out with that. And Jeff Brohm definitely fits that mold. And to give you an example, or to give you kind of an indication of sort of how plugged in they are here, you know, Greg Brohm is on that staff up there in a, like a administrative role. Greg Brohm still lives here and communicates. He commutes, you know, to West Lafayette when he's there in town. Like, he never even left.
Wow.
They are that sort of dialed in, and obviously their dad, Oscar, is a huge figure here in town, from a legendary high school football coach, all played here. It's a pretty intense kind of emotional, you know, connection. And also there's a little bit of kind of juicy inside baseball when Jeff Brohm was on the staff for Steve Kragthorpe after Petrino left the first time, and things started to go south with Kragthorpe very fast. Tom Jurich ran both of the Brohm brothers off, Jeff and Greg, in the name of defending Steve Kragthorpe. And there was a big rift there. And the fact that Tom Jurich is gone now is really the only reason that Jeff Brohm would be an option now. And I think that he's kind of drawn, at least a little bit, to the idea of being able to come back and fix Tom's mess that Bobby left here in the wake of both of them being fired. So I think that's a factor, too.
Yeah, almost a way to kind of middle fingers up to Tom Jurich and show the mistake he made. Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. Now, I mean, do you think he's going to take the job? I mean, it seems like all signs are pointed that way. We know that. But, you know, you never know until pen goes to paper. Do you ultimately think he takes it?
I think he will. But I think one of my bosses at work has said it best. He seems to know him pretty well. He thinks he's going to take the job, but he's not going to give him a discount. You know, Jeff's got all of the leverage.
Yeah.
He doesn't have to take the job. He's got Purdue in pretty good shape. They're going to make a bowl again. He's about to sign, if he stays there, close to a top 25 recruiting class at Purdue, of all places. He's got all the leverage in the world. I think he wants to take the job here, but he realizes, look, you only live once. He's going to cash in his leverage. They're going to have to break the bank for him, but I do think he'll take it in the end, and I don't think that they really are even all that concerned with a 1B candidate behind him. I think he'll end up taking the job. And in the end, it will look like just like the basketball search. There were lots of different names that you thought maybe would be good candidates for the job, but Vince Tyree wanted Chris Mack, and then the year was over. He went and got Chris Mack, and it took about a week. And I think this will probably go about the same way.
Yeah, for sure. Now, how much – well, I'll go this way. I started writing down for this conversation my top 25 coaching jobs, because I wanted to ask you if you think Louisville's a top 25 job. And Louisville's one of those schools where I think at first reaction you'd be like, yeah, it feels like a top 25 job. Then you start actually writing down all of the schools that fit the profile of top 25 job, and you're like, man, I don't know if it is. Like, it's close, and you're as close to the program as anything. Like, do you think that do you see Louisville as a top 25 job?
It's probably, in terms of like the objective, like the fundamentals, it probably isn't. You know, it's new. It's not in a place that's just like overflowing with talent to get guys and be there naturally. And it's not, it doesn't have just sort of the built-in traditional stuff that a lot of other places have. And I feel like I could name ACC, Big 12, and SEC schools. I could name 25 of them before I've gotten to one where Louisville's sort of on the same plane with them with the objectives. The thing that Louisville's got is the thing that Oklahoma has in spades, and that's just a whole lot of want to. Like, people just really want Louisville to be good here. And so they spend money, and they travel, and they build stuff, and they give. And they sort of are able to fake their age, you know, as a program, because people just want them to be good. And I really think ultimately it goes back to basketball. The fact that they won some titles as just like a self-made program, they're like, well, hell, we can do this in every sport. And so they want that with football too. I think as long as it's sort of guided the right way by the right person, it functionally is a top 25 job. And there typically have been a top 25 team, as long as not somebody, you know, not totally incompetent is at the helm. But just in terms of the objectives, it's not a deep populous state and that sort of thing. And I think that for that reason alone, most of the SEC, many schools in the ACC, Big 12, that sort of Big 10 are better jobs. But it can be, because people here just freaking really want it to be good.
Yeah, and one thing, granted, the Jeff Brohm situation means this is going to go to Brohm in all likelihood and it's over. But if Brohm wasn't even in the picture, I mean, Louisville might be the best job available. You don't know what's going to happen if something weird goes on with Urban Meyer, but this is going to be a slow coaching search across the country. So if it weren't Jeff Brohm, Louisville would still probably have it's pick of the litter in a way among coaches. You know, maybe Larry Fedora goes at UNC and they battle it out. But I don't see a lot of jobs with the similar profile and the resources that Louisville has coming open.
Yeah, that's you're right about that. I think one of the things that conspired against Bobby is just the overall timing. You know, Louisville doesn't have a lot of scholarships to give this recruiting class because it is a very young team with a very small senior class. Bobby's buyout magically doesn't go down after this year. It actually goes up just the tiniest bit, so you get nothing for waiting and giving him another year. And then this coaching carousel cycle, there's almost nobody. I guess Colorado's going to open up, Kansas, North Carolina, and maybe USC, but I think USC and Louisville's coaching pools aren't going to overlap very much. And so, yeah, you're right. It is all those things sort of conspired against Bobby to make this the ideal time to make coaching change. And I think they would have their pick of the litter if they didn't already have exactly who they want. And I don't know, did you watch him yesterday in the weekly press conference that he did? He didn't even sound terribly good at lying about not being interested in it either, which I found kind of interesting.
It's just I've never seen an AD, the coach that they want, like speaking about this, not deny, like even Scott Frost kind of denied it for a while. Roy Williams denied wanting to go to UNC 12 years ago. Yeah. Like they're really good at lying usually, but it feels like here they're just like, yep, nope, this is it. This is the guy. we're putting all our eggs in this basket. So if it doesn't happen, man, I can't imagine what would happen. And I would hate to be the guy. This is what I said on my show yesterday in Charlotte, as I basically said, if it's not Jeff Brohm, I would hate to be the guy who has to fill those shoes, because everybody knows that that's who they want. I can't imagine what it would be like to be that guy that comes in if you're not the number one choice.
No, I'm with you. I think that almost anybody else would be a pretty sore disappointment at this point, and that would be a shame for whoever it would be. And I can go ahead and say I think the people that I know that indicate, like, Vince is very much enamored with Dino Babers at Syracuse. And so I think that if things do fall apart with Jeff Brohm, which I don't anticipate,
right?
I think that Dino would be a guy that would be pretty high on his radar. And I think Dino's a pretty charismatic guy. I think he'd do fine winning people over post Jeff Brohm breakup, Hayes. But it would be a chore he would have to tackle. And I think, you know, one of the big factors in whoever's going to be the next coach here is there's a lot of PR work that needs to be done. Bobby locked out everybody. We got no practices, no interviews. We didn't get to talk to players. We didn't get to talk to him. We didn't get to talk to assistants. We got nothing. And he just made this all very bottom line. It was just like, we'll show up to the games, and we win or we lose, and that's it. And I think the next guy's got to come in and be very, very keen on fan booster re-engagement, people getting to know the coaches in the program. And Jeff Brohm, you know, has already done all the homework there. He knows everybody. There would be no work for him to do that. And I think it's one of the reasons he shows up as the most attractive candidate. He does all of that re-engagement overnight.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because Virginia Tech is somewhat going through something similar now. Now, they're not about to fire Justin Fuente, but Fuente's walled the program off at Virginia Tech. Yeah. And he's really not allowed the media nowhere near the access they had when Frank Beamer was there. The fans, there's a sense among some people in the fan base that they don't feel connected to the program anymore. And it's all well and good when you're winning 9-10 games a year. Like, you can tolerate that. But as soon as you go 5-7 or whatever it is, all of a sudden that's not very fun anymore. So how much of a role did that play in just Petrino just walling off the program? Did that really create a sense of animosity between the fans in the program? It feels like it did.
Yeah, I don't know if I would necessarily say animosity, but what it did was it just made this like a very professional arrangement.
Yeah.
It was like, I'm going to do the coaching and we're going to win or we're going to lose. And that's it. And then, like, we don't get the human interest stories. I'll give you just a parallel or a opposite of this. You know, Charlie was actually pretty liberal with access to both him and the assistants and the players. And so, like, we knew a lot about all the players. And we knew that Teddy Bridgewater's mom had cancer. And we knew that Eli Rogers' mom, they grew up friends, and that she had AIDS. And we knew that Lorenzo Maldon was an orphan. You know, and we got to see Charles Gaines in practice say, like, I run with animals and just be a character. And, you know, but you endear yourself that way. And so year two, when Charlie starts out 2-4, like, there was no panic because people liked Charlie. They knew the players. They endured a lot of that. And the thing that I think access, and I think coaches don't get this, is that when you do give at least some access, not absurdly overly large amounts of access, but just some, you buy yourself a little something for people to hold on to when you're not just winning or just losing.
Yeah.
You don't make it a professional arrangement. You make it a relationship, a marriage. And I think that Bobby never understood that. It was all about control. And so he's fine to put up with being prickly and being distant when they're winning 9-10 games, et cetera. But when they start to go south and go super south, there was nothing left to grasp. It was just like, all right, can we stop doing this now? Because this isn't fun.
It feels that way, too. I hope, for my own sake, that doesn't start to happen at Virginia Tech. But we'll see. It doesn't feel good right now. I want to ask you this. Is there any sense of anxiety that Kentucky is doing what it's doing right now with Mark Stoops, and it feels like they've passed Louisville in the hierarchy in the state?
You know, I think that it doesn't help. I think you'd be naive to say that it's not a factor. And I think that it has gone the other way, too. I think that when Louisville started to ascend under Charlie Strong, it hastened them running Joker Phillips out of there.
Yeah.
You know, prior to that, too. It happens. I think you'd be a fool. Florida State, the same thing happens. Michigan, Ohio State, same thing happens. So, I think it is a factor. And I think it's a good example of that is, you know, we're having in Kentucky most years not a ton of in-state prospects. If you want to have a good football program in Kentucky, you got to recruit Ohio, you got to recruit Georgia, Florida, etc. But in the state, and particularly in the city of Louisville, it's a really good year. There are 7 or 8 four-star kids in this state, and we never have that many here. And 6 out of the top 10 kids in the state are here in the city of Louisville, and right now Louisville's got none of them committed, 0, in your own city. And Rondale Moore is playing for Purdue. And that kid grew up here and never wanted to leave. And Louisville didn't really recruit him hard enough at all. And so I think Kentucky being better is hurting. But Kentucky getting some local kids and Louisville's not is really, to me, what more has ratcheted up the pressure than anything else. They are at least able to persuade some of the really good players in state to go there. Louisville's not been able to get any of them. So that, to me, has been a bigger factor than even them just having a good year.
Interesting time at Louisville for sure, man. Hey, well, it's all going to be okay. You're going to have Jeff Brohm. You guys are going to be winning ACC titles in 3 years. Don't worry about it. It's all going to be okay.
I'm going to watch that XFL video of him.
Oh, my gosh.
100,000 times.
Just get him fired up. That should just be – they all play that in the opening press conference when they introduce him here in like 2 weeks. So, well, it sounds like Brohm's going to be the guy. So everything's going to be okay. The night is darkest before the dawn or something like that.
That's right.
There you go. So everything will be all right for Louisville. I have faith in you guys. So, all right, man, I appreciate you coming on. That was a lot of fun. Nobody better to talk about Louisville than you, so I'm glad you had the time.
I'm happy to do it. And by the way, buck up about Justin Fuentes. Get that thing turned around.
Okay. Oh, yeah. I feel good about it, too. Some fans don't like to pay attention to facts and, you know, context and things like that, and they just want to, you know, pull the plug now. But everything's going to be okay. We'll be fine.
All right, buddy.
All right.